The Zodi by Hayworth, featuring asymmetrical 3D lumbar support, online at sitforless.com.
From Public Radio International, I'm Ray Suarez.
And I'm Deborah Amos, and this is America Abroad.
America Abroad is Public Radio's monthly program exploring the critical international issues of our time. This hour, pipeline politics and Caspian conflict.
The existing pipelines from the Caspian Sea go to the north. Here. The oil is put on board the tankers, shipped across the Black Sea down to Istanbul. The explosion would destroy Istanbul, contaminating the Bosphorus for decades. And there'd be only one way to get the oil out.
Yeah, down south, to the Med, the King Pipeline.
Electra's pipeline.
Pipeline politics aren't only the stuff of spy movies, as residents of Georgia saw firsthand this summer. The conflict with Russia wasn't just about breakaway provinces. It was another chapter in the very real struggle over the pipelines that bring Caspian crude to the rest of the world. For many people, it took James Bond films or Borat to make them even aware of places like Azerbaijan or Kazakhstan. But those countries and the rest of the stands, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, are former Soviet states with rich and complicated histories.
It's an area that's kind of in the middle of the Silk Road.
Martha Brill Olcott is with the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and she's studied the region for decades.
If you go from China to Europe by land, you must pass through Central Asia. Marco Polo did, Alexander the Great did, Genghis Khan did.
Today, the lifeblood of the region is no longer silk, it is oil. And that gives their countries more clout to assert their independence from their former rulers in Moscow. And the Caspian states are also a stomping ground for a lot more than the kings and explorers of the past. Martha Brill Olcott.
Several states in the region border on Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda camps from Afghanistan prior to September 11th were a source of terrorists for these states.
The peril of Islamist radicalism is matched by the promise of resource riches. The Caspian is estimated to have some of the largest oil and gas reserves on the planet. And when the USSR collapsed, Russia didn't find it easy to let go. Zeno Baran directs the Center for Eurasian Policy at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C.
Well, for Russia, what has been very important is to maintain its monopoly on the Caspian oil and gas reaching world markets, especially Western markets, and maintain that region as its basically backyard.
As we'll explore in the program, that all changed with a multinational proposal to build an oil pipeline from Azerbaijan through Georgia to Turkey, the first to bypass Russia. But the recent war between Georgia and Russia raises concerns about the security of the pipeline and about Russian intentions in the region. So this hour, we'll take a look back at how the competition for control of the Caspian has developed between Russia, China, and the West.
But first, America Abroad went to Azerbaijan to see how the recent conflict is affecting pipeline politics in the Caspian. Tension is nothing new for Azerbaijan. It's long been the focus of foreign powers vying for control of the region. Today, the independent Republic of Azerbaijan lies between Russia, Georgia, Armenia, and Iran, and it's bordered by the Caspian Sea to the east. Because of its strategic location, it was at the center of a three-way battle between Persian, Turkish, and Russian empires for centuries.
We are in the heart of Sangachal Terminal. Now, the Sangachal Terminal is one of the largest oil and gas terminals in the world, and right now we stand in front of the place where the famous Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil export pipeline is leaving the terminal and sent into the system.
Rashan Bayramov gave us a tour of the Sangachal terminal on the shores of the Caspian Sea. He's a spokesperson for BP in Azerbaijan. The British-owned energy company operates the pipeline and leads the consortium that owns it.
Oil itself is transported from the offshore fields via subsea pipelines, which then enter the Sangachal terminal. And then, of course, they are processed for further transportation through the BTC pipeline.
At close to 1,100 miles, the BTC is the world's second longest oil pipeline. It's also the first Caspian pipeline to run from east to west. Before the BTC, the only pipelines out of Azerbaijan ran north-south through Russia. The BTC takes oil from the Caspian Sea through Georgia to the Turkish seaport of Ceyhan. From there, the oil is loaded onto tankers and shipped to energy-hungry markets across Europe.
The BTC pipeline is of tremendous strategic, economic, and political importance for Azerbaijan and the region. One of the purposes, of course, is diversifying the oil sources to Western Europe. So it brings, like I said, 1 million barrels of oil per day, which is a significant amount of oil. It does help the European countries to reduce its dependence on other sources of energy. And then helps Azerbaijan to enter many different kinds of contracts and relationships with many Western countries.
That's the good news. But for a former Soviet state, particularly one rich in natural resources, getting out from under Russian influence was never going to be easy.
Azerbaijan is the key country in the South Caucasus. It's the key producer of oil and gas, and it's the key transit country. That's why Russia is focusing on Azerbaijan.
Elhan Shashinolu is an Azeri energy analyst. We spoke to him at a busy cafe in thriving downtown Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan.
Once the Soviet Union fell apart, Azerbaijan became the owner of its own resources, and the question was how to get the best use for them. The best offers came from Western companies, and Azerbaijan decided to work with them to develop its oil and gas fields. From that point onwards, Moscow started to pressure Azerbaijan because it didn't want the country to sell its resources to the West.
The main goal of Azerbaijan is diversify of its oil transportation directions, and stability in our region depends on Russian-Azerbaijan relations.
Vusal Kasumla is deputy chairman of Baku's Economic Research Center.
But, you know, we can't get from Russia new technology, democracy, and other main important issues for our state construction, market economic construction. And in this case, we're obliged to increase our relations with Western countries.
Western influence in Baku isn't new. American and European investors came to the city during its first oil boom, at the end of the 19th century. Their influence is still visible in the Italian-style palazzos built by the era's newly minted millionaires, and in the elegant Fountain Square at the heart of the city center. These days, Fountain Square is a busy shopping and cafe district. A small street market on the edge of the square sells ornate Persian slippers, Soviet memorabilia, and Turkish ceramics, a reminder of the country's multicultural heritage.
I'm Ali Gara. I'm from this country. I'm from Azerbaijan. I speak this language. I mean, I am native of this country. For example, in our language, we have lots of Persian words. I mean, language itself is Turkish, Turkic, but we have lots of Persian words. Our great poets, they used to write poems in Persian. Then Russians came, so all our like thinkers, they are Russian speakers. And then we are now independent, the emphasis is on speaking our own language, going back to our own roots. And especially after independence, we have lots of influence coming from Turkey because now everyone has a satellite TV. But people who are, let's say, over 40, 50, maybe they have this nostalgia for Soviet times, so they might be more Russian, pro-Russian. For some others, especially people in the south, living in the southern parts of the country, they are close to Iran, they are maybe more religious, they actually appreciate more their Iranian links and Iranian roots. For me, the beautiful part of it is that it brings together all these beautiful elements.
Azerbaijan's government also tries to bring all these elements together in its foreign policy. Vusal Kasumla of the Economic Research Center.
There are two strategic triangles in our region. First triangle is Russia, Armenia, and Iran, which is against Western countries, against Europe, and against United States policy in this region. The second triangle is Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Georgia. And nowadays, our policymakers try to get some reconciliation between these triangles.
and for many years, Azerbaijan maintained good relations with Moscow and with its Western partners. But the recent conflict between Russia and Georgia highlighted the country's precarious position. Zeno Baran of the Hudson Institute.
Georgia's stability and security was, of course, really important for Azerbaijan to be able to send its oil and gas westwards. When Georgia was being bombed, it first and foremost affects Azerbaijan. And the pipelines were shut, just not because they were affected, but for security reasons. And some of the Georgian ports were unusable. So that really affected Azerbaijan's economy.
And that's no accident, Baran says. Although the recent conflict was ignited by issues concerning the breakaway state of South Ossetia.
And what happened in Georgia is, if not directly, but indirectly related to this basically Russian attempt to prevent any non-Russian controlled gas reaching Europe.
Leyla Jervanadze agrees. She's an energy analyst based in Tbilisi, Georgia.
Russia also sent a message to both sides, producers in the Eastern Caspian and consumers in the West. Hey, I am a serious person here, and I have my own interests, and these interests should be somehow taken into consideration while talking about the region and future projects. The security of these pipelines depend on me, not the U.S. fleet, which is based in the Mediterranean, not anybody else, but I am the guarantor. For future projects, I am here, and if you choose to transship more oil and gas through this route, you have to think first, because this is not quite safe.
But Azeri economist Vusal Kasumla says that while Azerbaijan still needs Russia, Russia can't afford to alienate its small neighbor either.
Russia is not our dream neighbor, but Russia is our biggest neighbor. You know, Azerbaijan is stronger than 10 years ago. It is oil and gas pipelines. Maybe Azerbaijan government invite NATO troops to Azerbaijan. All these aspects are the tools in the hand of Azerbaijan government in order to impact Russia.
In the end, though, says analyst Leyla Jervanadze, Azerbaijan could still decide that its economic interests ultimately lie with Russia.
Russians started very serious negotiations with Azerbaijan on the purchase of whole volumes of gas that Azerbaijan potentially could produce. And if they offer good terms, I mean, we don't know how they would not accept such a deal.
And while she agrees, the future is uncertain. Zeno Baran of D.C.'s Hudson Institute says there are greater stakes at play.
If countries like Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan were only interested in making money, then maybe they would sell their gas to Russia. But they are first and foremost interested in using their energy to secure their freedom, security, sovereignty, and long-term well-being. And that is why they would rather wait. But it's not going to be so easy because many of these countries are dependent on Russia for general economic relations. And Russia has been able to threaten them with gas cutoffs or embargoes on their economic products. So it's a very tough game that's being played right now.
For America Abroad, I'm Ray Suarez. Sign up for our monthly podcast, visit us on the web at americaabroad.org. Coming up after the break, Deborah Amos traces the history of the competition for resources in the Caspian since the collapse of the Soviet Union. You're listening to Pipeline Politics and Caspian Conflict from America Abroad.
I'm Deborah Amos, and you're listening to Pipeline Politics and Caspian Conflict from America Abroad.
Well, the Juniper girls really knocked me out. The West behind. And Moscow girls make me sing and shout. And Georgia's always on my mind.
Georgia's been on the mind of just about everyone lately, after America's small ally got into a big conflict with its neighbor to the north. In that war, the Russian bear roared loudly and sent a message that reverberated throughout what Russia calls its near abroad. Much of that near abroad centers around the Caspian Sea. It's a region rich in oil and gas that other major powers don't want to concede to Russia. The intense interest has prompted some commentators to label what's going on in the former Soviet Republic a new great game, a reprise of the 19th century competition between Britain and Russia over the greater Caspian area. But is this the great game all over again?
First of all, it is enormously condescending to the countries themselves.
Fred Starr, chairman of the Central Asia Caucasus Institute at Johns Hopkins University, disagrees.
There are three independent countries in the Caucasus, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. On the other side of the Caspian, there are also three. Uzbekistan is not quite on the shoreline, but it's there, Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. These are states. Why should they be the object of a game?
The quest of these newly independent republics to put their sovereignty on solid footing hasn't been easy, as NBC reported in early 1992.
The hatred is centuries old, but the weapons, ultra-modern. The conflict between Christian Armenia and Muslim Azerbaijan is no longer just an ethnic or religious feud. It is all-out war.
Soviet rule kept a lid on a myriad of tensions throughout the empire, and once that rule ended in the winter of 1991, the lid came off.
Between Armenians and Azeris, no ceasefire has held. The battle over this land, Nagorno-Karabakh, an enclave claimed by both its inhabitants, Armenians, and its ruler by law, Azerbaijan. But that was Soviet law. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union, fighting between these two newly independent states has raged on.
Fighting in the former Soviet Union wasn't limited to Azerbaijan and Armenia. Native Georgians clashed with ethnic minorities in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and a civil war raged in the Central Asian Republic of Tajikistan. Back then, Moscow's Boris Yeltsin inherited a decrepit Soviet economy and ethnic cleavages that threatened to destabilize Russia itself.
All agreed this summit was the most fruitful to date, but only minor accords were signed. Russian President Boris Yeltsin defended the Commonwealth, saying it would survive. But he had to defend himself against attacks by Russian lawmakers back in Moscow, who accused Yeltsin of arriving drunk to the summit.
Despite weaknesses at home, Russia tried to exert some influence on its former colonies, Fred Starr.
Understandably, the Russians tried to put organizations together that would give some continuing relationships with their former colonies. They looked at the British Commonwealth and said, gee, that's a good idea. They created the Commonwealth of Independent States. Well, this has gone nowhere.
It went nowhere because these newly independent states weren't eager to re-enter the Russian fold.
I think the response of the countries in the Caucasus and Central Asia has been very rational, and that is, if we have to join, join, but join every other club as well, and have such a complicated web of memberships and credit cards, if you will, that you can play them off against each other, which in the long run is what works, and they're all doing it, and we should wish them well in that, even though we ourselves get played off against from time to time.
And a large part of that game is using whatever assets they have to assert their autonomy. For many, those assets can be found in the ground. An official video from the Republic of Kazakhstan touts that country's potential.
Stable and prosperous, Kazakhstan has become the economic engine of Eurasia. Blessed with abundant natural resources and a globally minded, educated workforce, Kazakhstan has attracted 80% of all foreign direct investment to the region. Central Asia's economic tiger, a strategic partner linking China, Russia, the West, and the Muslim world. Kazakhstan in the 21st century.
But even though these countries had the resources to make themselves independent, they didn't have the means to get those resources to market.
But like other Central Asian countries, Kazakhstan's tether to Russia is hindering progress. The Tengiz oil field, a colossal reserve which could change the face of the industry. But just like Turkmen gas, its vast potential has hit a roadblock. The best way out leads through Russia, which again wants to control the oil.
And we'll hear later in the program, the Caspian countries work closely with the Clinton administration to help break the Russian stranglehold on the region's resources by building the Baku-Jehan pipeline. And it wasn't just the U.S. that demonstrated interest in Caspian oil and gas. Fred Starr.
Interestingly, the Chinese, who have a very grave energy shortage, looked to this region too and said, how do we get this oil and gas to China? And just at the same time that we were working on Baku-Jehan to open the door to the West, the Chinese were pushing the Russians to open the East. There is a real tension between Russia and China's aspirations in this region.
While China and the West focused on the potential oil and gas bonanza, Central Asia was becoming another hotbed for radical Islamists.
February 1999, a series of bomb blasts rocked the capital of Uzbekistan. An Islamic group is blamed for killing 16 people and injuring more than 100.
In the 1990s, growing Islamist extremism in Central Asia seemed a distant threat. But after September 11, 2001, it became clear that what happened in Central Asia mattered to the United States. The Bush administration launched Operation Enduring Freedom to eradicate the Taliban regime and to root out al-Qaeda from its sanctuary in Afghanistan. But to do that, the U.S. would need help from the states of Central Asia. Secretary of State Colin Powell flew to Uzbekistan in December of 2001.
I applauded Uzbekistan and the president personally for the political courage shown by him, his government, and his people to assist us in this campaign.
Before the terror bombings, the U.S. saw Karimov as a strongman ruler, known mostly for his brutal suppression of human rights. Now, however, the U.S. is building a war coalition, and Karimov just made partner.
When the U.S. established bases in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, Russia gave its tacit approval. After all, radical Islam was a grave threat to Russia as well. But the presence of American troops so close to home soon made Russian leaders nervous. That anxiety was compounded by a growing democracy movement in the Republic of Georgia during the winter of 2003.
Tonight, fireworks lit the night sky over Georgia's parliament building. Just moments after the crowd first heard the news, it seemed the whole city poured into the streets to celebrate.
Georgia's future president, Mikhail Saakashvili, spoke during the heady hours after protesters stormed the parliament, clamoring for democratic change.
People call it a rose revolution. I mean, it was accidental. I just held a rose in my hand. But in many ways, it was a very velvet, peaceful, very, you know, democratic revolution.
In May of 2005, President Bush came to Tbilisi to congratulate Georgia on its rose revolution.
The path of freedom you have chosen is not easy, but you will not travel it alone. And as you build a free and democratic Georgia, the American people will stand with you. Now across the Caucasus in Central Asia and the broader Middle East, we see this same desire for liberty burning in the hearts of young people. They are demanding their freedom, and they will have it.
Just days after Georgians said goodbye to President Bush, another uprising in the former Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan began. The Uzbek government used devastating force to silence the crowds.
30 miles away, Uzbek troops are back in control of the city where the revolt began yesterday. Witnesses say soldiers quashed the rebellion there by opening fire on thousands of demonstrators, many of whom were unarmed.
The violence in Uzbekistan drained a spotlight on the tension between America's national interests and its values. U.S. officials responded by criticizing Uzbek President Islam Karimov. As a result, America was asked to vacate the airbase it had occupied since the fall of 2001. And soon after, Uzbekistan signed a treaty of alliance with Russia. It was one example of Moscow's effort to reclaim an area the Kremlin considered its own backyard.
As helicopters fire rockets and aircraft scream overhead, an alliance grows stronger between the leaders of Russia, China, and a handful of former Soviet states. Collectively known as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the group says its goal is stability in an oil and mineral-rich Central Asia. Western analysts, though, say the real motive is to put on a show of force against Western influence in the region.
The authoritarian leaders of Central Asian states view the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as a way to deflect Western demands for more democracy. It's also one more way for these states to diversify their alliance portfolio. For the rest of Russia, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization was just another way to extend control. Recently, Moscow has taken a more direct approach. In the summer of 2008, tension between Georgia and Russia in the disputed territory of South Ossetia erupted into war.
Georgian troops launched a major offensive against separatists in South Ossetia today. Now, Russia then sent tanks into the province, vowing to protect its peacekeepers there, as well as many South Ossetians.
With so many outside players vying for power in this resource-rich and geographically strategic swath of territory, the situation today does bear at least a passing resemblance to the old great game. But Fred Starr says this new game is critically different. The most important players are in the region.
All the talk about great games and so on conceives this region as a kind of giant donut, with Russia, China, India, U.S., Europe, Turkey out on the edge of the donut, arguing over the center, which is basically hollow. What's happening now is we're understanding, wait, that's exactly wrong. This is the center of the Eurasian landmass. This is going to be, again, as it was for 3,000 years, the crossing point of the great continental trade routes. These areas, which we've become accustomed to view as backwaters, are going to be centers, and they're going to have a culture and civilization that partakes fully of the West, partakes fully of the East, partakes of China, India, Europe, Middle East. This is very exciting prospect.
Countries inside the donut strive for independence, while powers outside hope to gain influence in the center of the Eurasian landmass. Whether you call it a game, great or not, it's clear the stakes are high. I'm Deborah Amos for America Abroad.
I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Pipeline Politics and Caspian Conflict from America Abroad.
Support for America Abroad comes from the Carnegie Corporation, the Stewart Family Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Foreign Affairs online at www.foreignaffairs.org, and from The American Interest, a magazine devoted to illuminating America's global role.
I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Pipeline Politics and Caspian Conflict from America Abroad.
The Caspian Sea isn't really a sea. It's a great big lake, and it's landlocked. So the problem isn't so much getting the oil out of the Caspian Sea, is getting the Caspian Sea oil out to the rest of the world.
The story of how some of that Caspian crude eventually got to the rest of the world is as much about geopolitics as it is about oil. After the collapse of the USSR, the former Soviet republics were intent on making sure they no longer took orders from Moscow. One critical step toward independence was building an umbilical cord to the West in the form of an oil pipeline. But the project ran into fierce opposition. Russia wanted to maintain control of the Caspian's resources, and oil companies weren't interested in shelling out billions to build a new pipeline. Early on, the pipeline seemed more like a pipe dream.
In 1992, March of 1992, we just came to Shevardnadze's office with this idea that there are some in the discourse regarding this transportation of oil from Caspian Basin to the outer world.
Tedo Dzhaparidze was an advisor to the former president of Georgia, Eduard Shevardnadze.
And why not to consider, you know, to have Georgia as a link, you know, some sort of transit, you know, space for this oil? And his first reaction was, you know, get out of my room, because if it happens and we start talking about this transportation of, you know, Caspian energy or Azerbaijani, you know, energy, the oil through Georgia to Western markets, Russians would get mad. It was his, you know, initial reaction.
Dzhaparidze was discussing what was then a vague proposal to build an east-west energy corridor that would bring Caspian oil and gas to Western markets. Though upsetting Russia was a major concern, Shevardnadze realized that the proposal had a huge upside, says Tedo Dzhaparidze.
But literally in 15 minutes, he called me back and said in a very quiet manner, said, you know, Tedo, keep working on this issue, and I would call you later whenever I decided appropriate for us. We succeeded to engage, you know, President Shevardnadze into this discourse. The idea was that this project, this may help Georgia to become, you know, really independent and a capable state and attract as much as possible, you know, the Western interests.
That interest came in the form of oil companies.
There's a full bar most every night at Finnegan's Pub, but this isn't Dublin or Greenwich Village. It's downtown Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. And the bar talks all about oil and money, mostly money.
In 1994, Azerbaijan, the tiny, resource-rich republic that sits on the Caspian Sea, inked what was called the Contract of the Century. It was a deal with a consortium of oil companies to develop Azeri fields. While the consortium explored the Caspian for untapped oil reserves, Turkey, Georgia, and Azerbaijan began to work out plans for a pipeline that would not only bring oil to the West, but also peace and prosperity to the Caucasus.
Let me say this. It's not only a pipeline.
Süleyman Demirel was the president of Turkey from 1993 to 2000.
I think from now on, these countries should be able to make their transformation from communist regime to democratic regime, and we have to be helpful to them. And that's why we have been getting together, not only to buy petroleum. You can buy petroleum from any village.
The idea was to build a 1,100-mile-long pipeline that would snake from the Azeri capital of Baku on the Caspian Sea through Georgia and down to the Turkish port of Ceyhan on the Mediterranean Sea. It would be called the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan, or BTC pipeline. The three countries involved sought to enlist American backing for the project. The Clinton administration worried about further provoking a Russia that was still smarting from the collapse of the Soviet Union. But supporting the independence of the former Soviet republics was also a high priority.
Don't forget, the former Soviet Union only broke up in, 1991. Some of these countries were struggling to maintain themselves, and we were trying to do everything we could to help them.
Ambassador Richard Morningstar was the Clinton administration's point man for the Caspian energy policy.
We had a policy of multiple pipelines that should come from the region, that no one country should monopolize those pipelines, and that by building multiple pipelines, that would also help to sustain the independence of the new countries in that region.
But not everyone was so enthusiastic about pipeline diversity. The Georgian president had been right when he worried about the disapproval from the Kremlin.
And by the way, there was interesting, you know, exchange between President Shevardnadze and Yeltsin. Yeltsin talked about, "Hi, Edward, how are you? What's going on in Georgia?" And in the end, he suddenly said, "Oh, no, Edward, I heard that, you know, there are some discourse or chat about some pipelines from Georgia." And Shevardnadze, he was smart enough to say, "What are you talking about, Boris? What pipeline? We do not have oil." But Yeltsin's message was, you know, you need to remember forever that if there is any pipeline, this should be just one pipeline and through the Russian territory. You get my message?
Richard Morningstar remembers meeting Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov.
When I was introduced to him, he said, "We know who you are and we know what you're doing and we don't like it." So he said it in a half jocular way, but it was also, you know, also somewhat biting.
But Russia wasn't the only country the Clinton administration was concerned about. The Islamic Republic of Iran is located on the southern shore of the Caspian Sea, and some of the oil companies hoped to send oil through that country. Again, Richard Morningstar.
We didn't want to see a situation where a pipeline went through Iran and then somehow, as a result of some crisis, Iran could turn off that pipeline. It just didn't make sense. Didn't make sense then. Doesn't make sense now.
What didn't make sense to the oil companies was the U.S. government dictating where the pipeline could be built. At $4 billion, the BTC carried a hefty price tag. So, with Iran a non-starter and another pipeline through Russia unacceptable, the oil companies pushed for a less expensive pipeline that would run from Baku to the Georgian port of Supsa on the Black Sea. Oil tankers would then sail from the Black Sea through the Bosporus Straits and on to the Mediterranean.
But it was not feasible in our view, and we made our views clear.
Mithat Rende was the deputy general for energy issues at the Turkish Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
The Turkish Straits are one of the most congested narrow waterways in the world. We had many accidents with loss of life and destruction of properties. And we made it clear to the oil companies that the Bosphorus cannot be used as a pipeline. We also told them, you know, Istanbul is a huge city and the strait was heavily inhabited. And so they could not risk any major accident.
In October of 1998, Richard Morningstar met at the White House with a consortium of oil companies headed by British Petroleum to reinforce the message.
I do remember that was a meeting where the companies pushed hard for a Baku-Supsa pipeline, and we made very clear that was just impossible. I think that's where I actually said to the companies, "Look, you know, it may be cheaper, but you can't have it because Turkey won't let you have it."
With the oil companies and the countries of the region squaring off, the media began writing the obituary for the BTC. The New York Times headline read, "U.S. bid to build Caspian pipeline appears to fail."
Well, sometimes respected newspapers can be wrong. I remember, though, the day that I saw that headline, I said, "Oh, my God."
But the oil companies were still not on board, so Turkey sweetened the deal by guaranteeing it would pay for cost overruns on the pipeline, and the U.S. chipped in by promising to help facilitate the financing of the BTC. In the summer of 1999, Ambassador John Wolfe took over for Morningstar as the Clinton administration's Caspian representative. He says a critical turning point in the negotiations came when British Petroleum CEO Lord Brown visited the White House.
I think he got a clear view that the administration was lined up solidly with the countries of the region, that we were prepared to negotiate in good faith, that we, on behalf of the Turks and with the Turks, had serious environmental objections, and that combination of politics, environment, and a willingness to talk price were more than substantial enough factors for BP to swing. And they did, and once they did, most of the coalition of companies broke.
President Clinton and the United States scored a victory today in a big power contest over control of the world's oil supply.
Dan Rather reported,
"Three nations have agreed to build an oil pipeline from the Caspian Sea to international markets without going through Iran or Russia. This pipeline agreement is a blow to Moscow, which sees it as the U.S. encroaching on its former empire in Asia.
We've made great strides toward the proposed Baku-Jehan oil pipeline and the Trans-Caspian gas pipeline.
President Clinton spoke to a group of Turkish business leaders during his trip to Istanbul.
These will help to diversify our sources of energy and help the newly independent countries of the Caucasus and Central Asia stand on their own feet. I'll bet if you polled the citizens of the United States and Turkey, over 90% of them would never have heard of the Baku-Jehan oil pipeline. But if we do this right, 20 years from now, 90% of them will look back and say, thank you for making a good decision at a critical time.
It took years to work out the finer points of the agreement and to actually build the pipeline. When the last terminal at Jehan began operation in the summer of 2006, John Wolfe was invited back to the opening ceremonies.
Seeing the oil tanker at the end of the jetty when the pipeline was opened really, really caused a lump in one's throat, because it was a tangible reflection of achieving what we set out to do. And the achievement wasn't ours, but it was really the peoples of the region who were going to benefit.
As oil flowed out of the region, economic benefits flowed in. But the BTC windfall wasn't primarily financial. Richard Morningstar.
I think it did pan out, and I'm glad we have a Baku-Jehan pipeline. Given the dependence on Russia today, on natural resources, particularly from Europe, I think it's good that not all of those pipelines have gone through Russia. Given our present relationship with Iran, it's good that they don't have a stranglehold on oil coming out of that region. I think that the pipeline will help to maintain the independence of Georgia and Azerbaijan.
I'm Ray Suarez for America Abroad. To share your thoughts on this and other America Abroad programs, visit us on the web at americaabroad.org. Next, Elizabeth Arnold travels to Moscow and Kazakhstan's capital city of Astana to explore the ties that bind the oil-rich former Soviet state to the Russian giant in its midst.
I'm walking just a few blocks from Moscow's Red Square in a pretty high-end shopping district that rivals New York's Fifth Avenue or Beverly Hills' Rodeo Drive. Right where I'm standing here now, you can see Prada, Tiffany, Ralph Lauren, not to mention some of the car dealerships, Ferrari, Jaguar, Mercedes-Benz. And what's made this high-end shopping possible is between here and Red Square, headquarters for Gazprom and Lukoil. In short, Russia's oil and gas industry. Russia is the world's largest natural gas producer and is second only to Saudi Arabia in oil production. But the key to Russia's energy wealth isn't just having it. It also lies in control of the transit of energy from its former republics to Europe. Here, inside Moscow's palatial National Hotel, under gilded chandeliers and portraits of czars, a who's who list of international dignitaries and businessmen are filing into a closed-door meeting. It's a high-powered conference on oil and gas transportation in Central Asia and the Caspian Sea, a region that's estimated to hold a third of the world's undeveloped natural gas and oil deposits. Konstantin Simonov, who was a featured speaker behind these doors, is an oil and gas economist here in Moscow and director of the National Energy Security Fund. He says he gave a long-term forecast for the region that was downright pessimistic.
It's possible that after 10 years we'll have a very big war, because in Central Asia we see a lot of contradictions. There is Europe, there is United States, there is China, there is Russia, soon there will be India. There is Muslim terrorists, so it's a very dangerous combination of different interests.
Everyone seems to want a piece of this place that Russia regards as its own backyard. Or, as President Medvedev put it, where Russia has privileged interests. When the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, the newly independent states gained ownership of what lay underground. But Russia still controlled the only pipeline linking that oil and gas with the West. By the time Vladimir Putin came to power in 1999, the U.S. and Europe were actively supporting creation of the alternative BTC pipeline so that companies like BP could move energy west from Azerbaijan through Georgia and Turkey and bypass Russia. The idea was to end the Russian chokehold and spur Western investment. Soon, the EU and the U.S. were talking about all kinds of alternative routes originating far beyond Azerbaijan, like Nabucco, the gas pipeline from Turkmenistan, all the way to Vienna. The list is too complicated for radio, but picture a labyrinth of routes purposely avoiding Russia, with Georgia as key to the transit. Russian economist Simonov says regardless of your position on the Georgia conflict, it raised a valuable lesson about moving oil. Showing that Georgia was vulnerable sent a warning to the newly independent states that there's a price to pay for throwing in with the West and trying to break the monopoly. Jonathan Simpson is a legal advisor on European gas pipeline deals with Russia.
It makes West investors very scared about contributing further money to develop and expand pipeline facilities within Georgia generally. And it makes them more reliant from a commercial perspective on Russian pipeline systems, which from a Russian perspective is quite a good thing. Their end game is to control the various access points and to use political pressure to ensure that production is routed through Russia. And they're quite far down the track, to be honest.
Again, having the oil and gas isn't enough. Control of transit is just as important.
Within the Caspian countries themselves, they have to balance not upsetting Russia with achieving commercial aims for the West. And it is a difficult position that they're in because they are subject to significant pressure.
Russia's turned its pipelines on and off like a faucet for leverage in the region since the 1990s. But recently it's also begun pursuing a more proactive strategy. For example, offering to pay Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Azerbaijan much higher European prices to secure long-term supply deals. And at the same time, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan agreed to build a pipeline to connect with the Russia system. Moves that all add up to a severe setback to Western hopes of a pipeline to Europe on a route that bypasses Russia. Julia Nanay, senior director and analyst at PFC Energy, has studied the region for more than a decade. She says what some call Soviet nostalgia is really just Russia being pragmatic.
For Russia, it's not really the military that's going to bind the countries of its so-called former empire back together. It's going to be energy and its energy networks. And quite frankly, you know, if you just look at where the energy networks go, especially from Central Asia, they still largely orient to the north. And I think Russia wants to make sure that that orientation remains and that the influence that Russia has within this region isn't diminished any more than it has been since the breakup of the former Soviet Union.
And that puts former republics in a delicate spot. Kazakhstan is a good example. A country that just over a decade ago didn't have a single private office building has been transformed by its staggering oil reserves. But it needs more pipeline capacity to move it. Oil-rich young Kazakhs in designer suits order bottles of Cristal like pitchers of beer here at Chocolate, the hottest nightclub in Astana, Kazakhstan's new capital. Astana is like a fledgling Dubai, a brand new, garish, glittering city marked by avant-garde office towers and President Nazarbayev's monument to himself, a 318-foot-tall tower topped by a giant gold egg with his own handprint inside. There's a bizarre energy here, and it's fueled by petrodollars. Russia, the U.S., China, even India have an eye on Kazakhstan's huge reserves. And Nazarbayev is fast becoming the master of the balancing act. But placating Russia and the West at the same time is formidable, and more than a few deals have gone awry. For example, Kazakhstan struck one with U.S.-based Chevron to take over its prized Tengiz oil field and the use of Russian pipelines to ship the oil. But the day Kazakhstan transferred ownership, Moscow cut the flow in half, citing environmental danger. Sanjay Srikantya, an economic advisor to the Chamber of Commerce here, says it was a not-so-subtle warning to industry.
You know, one of the big mistakes Chevron made is when they negotiated the Tengiz field is that they didn't figure out a way to get the oil out.
In the end, Chevron had to resort to the costly route of ships and rail.
While Kazakhstan's eager for Western investment, it is somewhat reluctant to challenge Russia's will. Sanjay points out nearly half of Kazakhstan's imports come from the former motherland.
When Nazarbayev has to make a decision, he's going to always tilt to Russia in the end. The closeness, the trade relationships, it's a very symbiotic relationship. You know, they need each other.
It's pretty easy to keep a finger on Kazakhstan's economic pulse from the U.S. Embassy here in Astana. It's situated a few blocks from Nazarbayev's enormous blue-domed presidential palace. And it's surrounded by a dozen giant sky cranes, swinging marble and gold-tinted windows to the steady march of new high-rise buildings. The U.S. ambassador here, Richard Hoagland, greets me himself at the door. He's only been in the post a month, but is no stranger to the region, having most recently served as ambassador to Tajikistan. He's also served in Turkmenistan, where China's building a new natural gas pipeline. Hoagland says Kazakhstan is also courting Chinese investment, and the U.S. is supportive of Nazarbayev's multi-vector approach.
We care for geostrategic reasons. We care for the independence of countries like this. We do not want to see countries like Kazakhstan, others in the region, falling under the special influence of one other country simply because Russia has said openly that's what they want. It would be a monopoly. It would be a financial monopoly, and it would be a political monopoly. Putin and Medvedev have said, yes, that's what they want. But I don't think that's what President Nazarbayev wants here.
And as Hoagland is the first to admit, it's far too simplistic to see competition over the region as simply between Russia and the West, a sort of new Cold War with pipelines instead of missiles. Ultimately, the bulk of Central Asia's oil and gas may instead go in a different direction entirely to quench the enormous thirst of the East. If Russia continues to use its transit as leverage, China increasingly becomes a more attractive option. And far from the glitz of Astana, out on the vast, dusty steppe, pipe is already being laid that will move 400,000 barrels of oil a day from Kazakhstan to Xinjiang, China. For America Abroad, I'm Elizabeth Arnold.
You've been listening to Pipeline Politics and Caspian Conflict. For transcripts of interviews, visit us on the web at americaabroad.org. There you can sign up for our monthly podcast or give us your feedback on this and other programs. Aaron Lobel is our executive producer. Our program was produced by Sean Carberry, Hermione G., Monica Villavicencio, and Chris Williams. Our director of broadcasting and station relations is Steve Martin. I'm Ray Suarez. Join Deborah Amos and me next month for another edition of America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Support for America Abroad comes from this and other Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Peter Sagal. Saturday on the Best of Public Radio 2008, a conversation with Antonin Scalia about doing justice to the English language.
Just imagine the Gettysburg Address. We can't honor, we can't consecrate, we can't hollow this ground. Come on.
Join me and Fred Child for the Best of Public Radio 2008 and your chance to help make great radio in 2009.
Saturday from 9 to noon and again from 1 to 4.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming 2009 with three opportunities in January to enjoy the Russian National Ballet Theater performing the timeless story, Sleeping Beauty. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
This is WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2 and HD3, Urbana.